This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks.
There's no question this was the worst storm in Vermont's history.
This week, Vermont and other parts of New England are still recovering from the damage wrought by Tropical Storm Irene.
Meanwhile, in New Hampshire, it was the political winds a-blowing.
The man that created universal health care in Massachusetts will attend his first major Tea Party rally in Manchester, New Hampshire, on Labor Day weekend.
And President Barack Obama is getting ready to present his jobs plan next week.
There are significant things we can do if we work together in Washington, and that requires working with Congress.
But Speaker John Boehner says, sure, except we're not going to work with you on Wednesday. Well, joining us now to dig through the week's news is Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Jeff.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
Great to have you back, as always. And also with us today from Vermont Public Radio is Ross Sneed. He's news editor at Vermont Public Radio. Ross, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you, Ross. And let me just start, obviously, with the most pressing news in New England. That is about the continuing aftermath of Tropical Storm Irene. We just heard a couple seconds ago a cut from Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin saying that absolutely this is the worst storm Vermont has ever seen. Let's hear a little bit more from him.
We have whole towns that have seen their houses and community buildings washed into streams. I flew over and visited a community yesterday, where you literally see the caskets of cemeteries washed into the streams, the cemeteries that have been there for hundreds of years.
Ross, it does sound, virtually apocalyptic. Can you give us the latest? How is Vermont doing 5 days later after the storm?
Well, here's the one real challenge, Meghna. We had rain here again last night in some parts of the state. Unfortunately, that rain was over the flood zone, and the rivers rose again. In fact, at one point, the New York State Police were called in with a helicopter to rescue two bridge inspectors who were trying to take a look at one of the bridges on U.S. Route 7 that had gone out, and they were trapped by the high water, had to be rescued by helicopter. They were safe, but those rains also washed out yet another house in the town of Jamaica.
Wow. So it sounds like just one being battered one way after the other. How are those communities that we heard that were totally cut off from aid due to all the washed out roads? Have they been reconnected with the rest of the state?
Well, yes, in one fashion or another. Roads have been reestablished in all the communities. But even as the governor said in an interview we had with him a few hours ago, in some cases, they're little more than a goat path. They can get in with ATVs in all cases. They can get in with heavy equipment and with Humvees from the National Guard. But you certainly can't get in and out with vehicles. You need a four-wheel drive in almost all cases. And wherever there even is road access that has been reestablished, it's on these rather crude dirt roads that used to be, in the case of a couple of cases, U.S. Route 7, U.S. Route 4, Route 9. The east-west access routes all across the southern two-thirds of Vermont are in really rough shape. There's only one of the east-west access routes that really is fully open from about the top two-thirds of the state down.
And I wonder, Monday morning quarterbacking is really easy for those of us who don't actually have to deal with the direct aftermath of a disaster like this. But what is it that Vermonters are saying about the state's response to the cleanup and the aid, and also if you're getting any federal aid or federal assistance to help the state recover?
Well, there has been federal aid already. Early in the week, the U.S. Department of Transportation provided $5 million to begin some of the work. And then late in the day yesterday, the president announced a federal declaration for all public damage. That's to roads and bridges and that kind of thing. And that was for 13 of the 14 counties in Vermont. The 14th was not damaged. And then the federal government has also begun the process of declaring disasters that will free up assistance for individuals. And so that's happened for four counties so far. They were the first to get their paperwork in. Windham County, which is one of the hardest hit, got its paperwork in today, and we may have a declaration for that county by the end of the day.
Jeff Jacoby, let me bring you back in here. I mean, western Massachusetts was really sort of the hardest hit when it came to flooding. Not so bad here on the eastern side of the state. I mean, that did raise among some people this question of whether or not the storm was overhyped by the time it arrived in New England, or whether this is just one of those things that you have to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. So, I mean, I guess your take on how the state of Massachusetts responded to Irene.
You know, on this question of overhyped, I find myself listening to Ross, reading some of these stories, seeing the pictures of what's been going on in places that really were horribly affected by this, and finding myself thinking how easy it is for some of us to get very smug and very snide when there's a great big play, you know, build up in advance by the media, and we go through all this talk about, oh, everybody thinks that every little snow flurry is going to be another blizzard of 78. And then it passes you by, and it doesn't hit you so hard. And you think, oh, what a bunch of nonsense that was. You know, it's just the media looking for something to be sensationalistic about. And then you realize there are other places that got hit with everything that was expected and even worse. So it's just, you know, just a reminder to some of us, I think, to be a little bit more modest sometimes about how quick we are to say that all the hype in advance was meaningless. A few miles, you know, in one direction or another.
That's right.
And Hurricane Irene would have done tremendous amounts of damage to people who are sitting now saying, well, what was all that, you know, media buildup about? Mm-hmm. How's Massachusetts doing? Go ahead, Russ.
Well, I was just going to kind of underline that point, because that was really what happened in Vermont, because the storm actually veered just slightly to the west, maybe 20 to 50 miles to the west, beyond what it was expected to. And so it didn't track up the Connecticut River Valley quite the way it was supposed to. It just kind of sucked into the mountains, where all of this rain going down on these, you know, really steep slopes caused this hydrology that just hammered these towns in the valleys.
Yeah, a lot of people thought, not only in New England, but also further south, that this was going to be basically a coastal story. Mm-hmm. But in many places, it was an inland story. And, you know, and the damage that struck people, in many cases, I think it was kind of a damage that none of them had ever seen before. But just on the question of how Massachusetts has coped, I got to say, to maybe switch to a different mode. I was listening on BUR this morning to the interview with the woman who's the head of National Grid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, a tough interview. And, you know, it's not only BUR that's asking questions. Martha Coakley, the state attorney general, you know, was talking about, you know, investigating whether the utilities responded, blah, 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 as much as they should. And I got to say, for all of my sympathy for people who've been displaced or lost power, there's also something to be said for not expecting the impossible, not expecting that, you know, that huge amounts of damage can be turned around with the snap of a finger. Think to what it would have been like 10 years ago or 20 years ago in the aftermath of a disaster like this. People would have thought it would be ludicrous to expect that all power would be restored within, you know, 24 or 48 hours. So I think there is something to be said for acknowledging the fact that they didn't know at National Grid or any of the other utilities exactly what the hurricane was going to do. Nobody could have known until it was underway and, you know, and behind us. Crews immediately start working 24 hours around the clock. Is it really reasonable to expect that, you know, utilities are going to be able to do something that none of us would be able to do? I just to me, it's a reminder, a little bit of modesty and a little bit of lowering our expectations and our quickness to denounce whenever we see something we don't like.
I suppose, though, for some people, I heard that interview and another one that was done on WBUR a little earlier in the week, that part of the problem maybe is that sometimes when people see things like the lights going back on at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough before the neighborhoods around the stadium get their power back, it makes people wonder what's going on. Now, the head of National Grid explained that because Foxborough is basically plugged into higher power transmission lines, that it just happens first, and then they repair the smaller lines, the lower grade lines as they get out to the neighborhoods. But nevertheless, there's always this big question of communication, I guess, between government entities, businesses, and the people that they're serving. And like, how do you really sort of manage all that in the aftermath of a storm? And the reason why I bring that up is because this question of managing the aftermath, of course, has become politicized because this week in Washington, we also hear that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Association, is fast running out of money. They've got some $800 million left. And given the fact that the damage that hurricane/tropical storm Irene has caused is, you know, in the several billions, it's become a political question. So here is House Majority Leader Eric Cantor chiming in about this on Fox News Monday.
Again, just like any family would operate when it's struck with disaster. It finds the money it needs to take care of a sick loved one or what have you, and then goes without trying to buy a new car or put an addition onto the house.
Well, that's him referring to the fact that additional funding for FEMA, he would say, Eric Cantor said, needed to be matched by cuts elsewhere in the budget. So, Jeff, your take on that?
I think in the abstract, it's a perfectly appropriate point. In terms of practical politics, his timing was off, and his wording couldn't have been worse. Not even so much the wording, the lack of overt sympathy. And I'm thinking, you know, we're both parents. If you hear your child screaming and you run and you see that the child has fallen down and is bleeding, the first thing you do is get the bandages and give the hug and wash off the blood. And then you start to say, now, listen, I've told you, you can't run when you're going, you know, through that place. You're going to fall down and you're going to hurt yourself. Certainly, Eric Cantor has a reasonable point to make, but there was a more reasonable way that he could have made it.
But Jeff, I'm going to push you on this a little bit because, okay, so to use your metaphor about kids falling and hurting themselves, A, you got to have your bathroom stocked with Band-Aids, and B, this isn't a question of telling the kid, hey, don't run and hurt yourself. I mean, cutting other parts of the budget is the equivalent of saying, okay, well, you can't have your candy bar or apple now because we're not going to buy it. We're cutting that out of our household budget.
Listen, every analogy only goes so far. My point is just that there's a way to express sympathy, that you want to express sympathy when people are hurt, before you start talking about how, to use the president's analogy, you got to eat your peas or rip the bandage off or whatever his language was. I think what Cantor should have said he was on a talk show. He was on an interview program. He had to have something to say. I think the appropriate way to say it was, first of all, everybody who's been damaged by Hurricane Irene has to know the federal government will be there. If FEMA needs more resources, FEMA will have resources. The House of Representatives will work with the Senate, will work with the White House. We will make that happen. Nobody should have any concerns on that score. But as long as we're talking about this, and then go on to make the point, listen, we're only at the beginning of the hurricane season. There are more disasters coming. And we've got a government that's $15 trillion, in the hole. This is why we have to be able to talk like adults about where our money comes from and what we spend it on. There's a right way and a wrong way to say these things.
Ross, let me get you back in here. Go ahead.
I think it's, part of the danger of governing by talk show. I have to say that tape has played a lot of times in Vermont, and it hasn't been terribly well received because people interpreted it as saying, well, we might not be able to help you if we can't. We've just gone through these budget fights and the fight over the debt ceiling, and we know how it became brinksmanship. And people up here are saying, so what are you saying? If you can't find other places to cut in the budget, then we are out in the cold, and people are saying cold is coming very soon. Lots of worry up here about how to fix these roads before winter sets in. And then people hear this and they think we're just going to be caught up in this political machine in Washington and get chopped up and spit back out because we're a little state.
When you're playing at that level, you have to be careful about the words that come out of your mouth, because if they can be taken out of context or played by people who don't wish you well, they will be. And, Cantor's got to think that way the way they all have to think that way.
Yeah, well, if I may, I want to move over to another political issue that's actually just across the border from you, Ross, and that is what's going on regarding the GOP and the Tea Party in New Hampshire, specifically vis-a-vis presidential candidate and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, who on Sunday, for the first time ever, is going to be at a Tea Party Express rally in New Hampshire. This is a complete change, Jeff, from the, or maybe it's not, who knows, from the Mitt Romney that we've seen before, who really sort of turned his nose up and his hand away from the Tea Party.
Boy, Mitt Romney, when it came to making business decisions, if he had had the kind of too smart for his own good, constantly trying to calculate and recalculate and recalculate everything to three decimal points, he would never have been the success that he became. And yet when it comes to these political things, the mistake, I don't think, is that he's going to go talk to the Tea Party Express. The Tea Party is a major segment within the Republican Party. He's running for the Republican nomination. Of course he has to be talking to Tea Party voters. The mistake, what he did wrong, is that he's been ignoring them up until now. And while I'm not privy to his, internal mental workings, I got to think that he's figured, well, it's not going to do me any good with the broader, moderate mainstream with independent voters if I'm seen as being too close to the Tea Party. And anyway, who do I have to worry about? Michelle Bachmann. Now that Rick Perry is in the race, and now that he is dominating every opinion poll, leading Romney in every single subgroup, it just seems more than a little coincidental that now, for the first time, he's interested in talking to the Tea Party.
Ross,
well,
let me,
and it just,
go
doesn't
ahead.
It just show that Republicans haven't figured out how to navigate these waters? On the one hand, the Tea Party is a really effective and powerful force within the party, and yet it's not everywhere, because I think you're probably going to go to this in a moment, Meghna, but now they're trying to figure out who leads the party in New Hampshire.
That's right.
The Tea Party leadership hasn't done so well over there, so I think it was a calculation by Romney also about, well, where do I go? Who is the audience I'm trying to go for? And, you know, he's trying to run a 50-state strategy, and now he's we've seen Republican candidates do this before. You got to concentrate on these early states, and New Hampshire and Iowa are kind of different right now.
Well, Ross, let me just elaborate on the point that you just made. What you're referring to is the fact that the New Hampshire GOP just pushed out its old leader as of yesterday, Jack Kimball, who is also a proud member of the Tea Party. The GOP establishment there did not like the way he was leading the party. And that's why this Mitt Romney move just seems so interesting to me, because he was quoted in the Boston Globe as saying at a town hall meeting in Berlin in New Hampshire, he says that the Tea Party movement, the great thing about it is that Republicans of all backgrounds have coalesced. You're seeing a Republican Party united in a way that I haven't seen before. And obviously that's the opposite, really, of what's happening in New Hampshire. And if I understand correctly, Tea Party favorite Michelle Bachmann hasn't even been to New Hampshire since she first declared.
Well, and it just goes to prove what Jeff was talking about. I think, you know, it's all a matter of timing, and the timing does not seem to be going so well for Mitt Romney. He clearly has time to make up for this. But, you know, every time he tries to make a move, something either that he can control or in this case can't seems to go against him.
Let's just touch on one last political issue before we run out too much time, and that is a slew of jobs bills that are going to be unveiled next week. President Barack Obama wanted to lay his out on Wednesday, but that didn't quite work out so well because Speaker of the House John Boehner denied the president's request to give a speech to Congress, and so now the president's going to be doing that on Thursday, and I'm not exactly 100% sure what the reason that Speaker Boehner gave was, Jeff, but there was something about a Republican debate happening on Wednesday, which doesn't even seem to have bothered the Republican candidates.
The explanation that was given by Boehner, there was an extremely polite, very cordial, courteous letter that he sent to the White House in which he said, you've asked to come on Wednesday. You know, we've got the following scheduled Wednesday afternoon in the House, something about votes that are scheduled, and with the security sweep that will be required. It was a very sort of, you know, polite, anodyne way of saying, you know, Wednesday's not good for us. How would Thursday be? I don't think anybody really doubts that the reason that the president's people wanted to do this thing on Wednesday was so that they could upstage the Republican presidential debate that would be taking place, I think, in California at the Reagan Library at that very hour. This is politics. I think people understand that. And whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or a conservative or a liberal, I think it's perfectly understandable that you'd want to, you know, if you can give a little needle to the opposition. The only thing, frankly, I
understand that this is unprecedented, though.
Unprecedented for the House Speaker not to just automatically say yes. But you know what? We see all kinds of things that are unprecedented. I think what's interesting about this is that there's the level at which, you know, it's being played out on the surface. And then there's the subtext that everybody seems to know about, but none of them actually want to acknowledge openly. One side wanted to, you know, to upstage a debate taking place on the other side. You know, the Republicans didn't want to let that happen. I don't know why they don't just say it.
Ross, let me get your take on this.
Well, you know, the interesting thing to me is that the Republicans offered instead Thursday, as we know. Isn't there something else going on Thursday? I think
something
there might
about
be
football.
NFL football. Yeah. So, you know, they're both playing this on both sides. And I think out in the hinterlands, people are like, OK, enough already. Just get out of the playpen.
Well, and especially since this has to do with jobs, I think that's the thing that's gotten the most people's hackles up, that if there's one thing that most of America wants to hear, it's that what are the jobs plans coming out of Washington?
I'll tell you, I wonder about that, Meghna.
Oh, really?
I wonder how many people are real. I mean, if you stop 1,000 people at random on the streets of America and ask them, are you tuning in to hear what the president has to say or what the Republican response is going to be on jobs plans? I'm sure the great
You don't think more people would say yes to that than are you tuning in to the Republican presidential debate in California?
Or are you more interested in watching the NFL
the
football
football
game?
Might win.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, and because people are not listening to what's going on in Washington because nothing seems to be getting done. So it seems like they're just talking to each other anyway.
Right.
Well, on that note, if I may, let's move on to our are hubbubs, and that is those stories that we couldn't touch on in this conversation but are worth a mention. Adam, your hubbub.
Okay. A number of years ago, folks in Boston city government started looking at the possibility of zoning for a restaurant on Boston Common, the idea being to bring some life and some light to some of the darker corners of the park. And the focus eventually settled on the charmingly named Men's Comfort Station, which is this octagonal stone men's room that is in quite a state of disrepair. So a while ago, while this process was going forward, we heard that Danny Myers, the New York restaurateur, was interested in opening a Shake Shack there. And people were like, a New York burger chain on Boston Common? Seriously? Obviously, there was hope that it could be a local business of some kind. And then this week, lo and behold, look who signs a 15-year lease on the Comfort Station. It's the Earl of Sandwich, an Orlando-based hot sub chain. The owners claim to be descendants of the actual Sir Edward Montagu, the 17th century Earl of Sandwich. Of course, the city was asking for a lot with this deal. They wanted a 15-year, $50,000 a year lease for this tiny little facility that's going to cost $1 million to renovate. And Menino didn't want liquor there. So there's only a small pool of businesses out there that are going to take you up on an offer like that. But the Earl of Sandwich? Come on!
It's even less local. Jeff, your hubbub.
Well, mine isn't nearly so cheerful. I usually try to find hubbubs that are a little bit more amusing than this. There was a story that, in fact, this past week got a lot of attention in certain parts of the political spectrum, on conservative talk shows and on right-wing blogs and so forth. I saw next to no mention of it in much of the mainstream media. Andre Carson, a Democratic member of Congress, a member of the Black Congressional Caucus, speaking in Miami to a black audience, says to the blacks in his audience that these Tea Party members, some of them in Congress right now with this Tea Party movement, would love to see you and me hanging on a tree. Now, to have a member of Congress, a member of the Black Congressional Caucus, telling black voters and fellow black members of Congress that the Tea Party stands for lynching blacks, you know, I can understand that there could be all kinds of sharp political differences you might have, and I can understand that a member of Congress might strongly feel that minority interests are not being advanced by the priorities or the agenda of Tea Party Republicans. But isn't language like that so far beyond the pale, just way, way, way beyond anything that could possibly be considered civil? With all the talk that we've had in the wake of, you know, the Gabrielle Giffords shooting and the killings of those people in Tucson, all this talk about, you know, we got to watch our language and be a little bit more courteous and civil. This one really deserved a lot more attention than it got.
It doesn't seem as if passions have been ratcheted down at all. Ross, lastly to you, your hubbub.
Well, I'm going to take us back to the floods here in Vermont. You know, there has been a lot of gallows humor as people have been trying to recover from these floods. Here's another town that was hit, Weston. It's in the southeastern part of the state. It's the home to the Weston Playhouse, a very well-known summer theater. I'm sure a lot of folks in Boston have come up to that. Well, the Weston Playhouse went through a major renovation about a year ago, millions of dollars, and they reopened this summer, and they were having a great season. They were preparing for a world premiere of a show just this, I guess they did open last weekend. And then the floods came and it hit the Weston Playhouse and took out the brand new orchestra pit, some of the basement storage areas, and it included all the places where they store all of their costumes and props and all the rest. Well, this play was a period play that was set in the 1940s, and so they're trying to recover. They think they'll be able to raise the money, be able to rebuild. What's really interesting is people are just having a ball with this. They spread these tarps out on the lawn of the playhouse. They bring out all the costumes that were in there for this play to dry out. Well, it was a 1940s play. People say, have you been to our 1940s yard sale? That's what it looks like on the yard of the Weston Playhouse right now.
Well, Ross Sneed, news editor for Vermont Public Radio, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're quite welcome.
And Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe, always great to have you.
Always a pleasure to be here.